Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Chatting to Julie Poitras-Santos, who can't help but be enthused by her sheer exuberance about her work in bringing people together to walk and tell each other stories. A lecturer at an art school in Portland, Maine, on the east coast of the United States, she's travelled a lot to embed herself in many different communities. She is currently exploring people's sense of getting lost and the techniques they use to find their way again, both physically and metaphorically. In part, she uses a labyrinth, and in our conversation, we discuss how group walking of labyrinths can bring clarity in thought and a strong sense of camaraderie amongst strangers. We're walking on a warm summer's day in La Romure in southwest France, one of the entry points to the long-distance pilgrimage route known as the Camino de Santiago. So tell us a little bit about your current practice and how you got to where you got to in your current practice.
Sure. My work is site-specific. I've been making previously installations with performances and also these community-based projects, which increasingly have incorporated more walking. So I would say a very strong arm or component of my practice right now is creating temporary communities through walking and storytelling.
Temporary communities. Can you try and explain how temporary and how big?
Right. I think they're very much interwoven. So maybe I can go back and start with some work a little bit over 10 years ago as a lead-in. In 2006, I was working in a very tiny town in rural France in the Haute-Loire region, which was a village of 250. With a small trailer to live in, and I was invited to make a project with the community. And previous to that time, I had been making performances and exhibitions in gallery spaces. And in fact, at some point, someone looked at my performances, which were using materials like clay and chalk and honey and mark making, but they were always sort of arriving at the limits of the structures I was in. And they said, gee, it looks like you really need to get outside, like you want to get out of the space. And so this was sort of a coalescing of those two qualities, someone inviting me to work in the community and also this need that became evidenced by the work that it was looking outside of these box spaces. I didn't really know what I would do for a project. I had proposed something that related to the Camino de Santiago, which went through that town. And so I talked to a lot of people in the village, those who were open to meeting this oddity from another place, who spoke their language poorly. I walked along the Camino in that space, and through these conversations and my walks, I developed a project that was very simple. In a sense, the simplicity surprised me. I started to feel like the Camino was a river, and it had one direction, and the direction was towards Santiago. And that was sort of the aim of the pilgrimage. Then I thought of an old family story about a neighbor who had to have a string running from his house to the river to collect water, because he couldn't see, he was non-sighted, and he would follow the string to the river. So I took that story and put string from the village to the Camino de Santiago path and invited the community for the vernissage, for the opening. And we all walked from the center plaza about 2 kilometers down to the Camino, to the pilgrimage path. And along the way, we told stories. They talked about, it was a very agrarian area. They talked about the weather that year. They talked about, you know, rain, no rain, how the crops were going. And we also talked about the Camino and the pilgrimage route. And someone knew someone who had gone. It would take about 2 months from this place. And through that walking and storytelling, I was able to understand both that site, that place, that town, small town to which I was a stranger. Also, something about this river that passed through the town, this pathway, this pilgrimage path. And it was a really amazing moment of a kind of temporary community formed. So there was local farmers that came on the walk who knew nothing about contemporary art. There were the local librarian came, the mayor came, various people that I'd met along and during my time, 2 weeks there. It was just a moment, really. It felt like for that moment we came together and shared stories. And so that is something that I have followed a little in my work, is drawing from the site, drawing narratives or stories.
So yeah. Bring us a bit more up to date.
Absolutely, sure. So last year I did a project in Sweden. The title of the piece was Map and Universe. And again, it was going to a place that is new to me, coming in as the stranger, essentially, and cultivating a structure for an experience that involves walking and storytelling.
For those listeners who are less familiar with the world of the artist, being parachuted into a place is very common for artists, isn't it?
Right,
on a kind of residency or project. What a duration were you in this place in Sweden, for example?
I was there a month. During that time, I used a similar methodology of walking around the area. It wasn't on the pilgrimage path. And discovering pathways in the landscape. And I encountered people and met people along the way and invited them for the final event, which, you know, initially I didn't know exactly what it would become. But as I researched more and walked around more, I started thinking about the courtyard in this farm place where I was, this farmhouse where I was staying. Traditionally, they have something called a trelinga or something. It's like a four-length or three-length space that makes a courtyard, and it actually protects them from wind. And that courtyard is the center of life in the farm, in the same way a courtyard can, or a plus, can become the center of life in a town. So I like the sense of passage through the space, the crossing lines of people's pathways and animals' pathways. At the same time, I was researching labyrinths, stone labyrinths, that were built in Scandinavia near the sea. We were only 2 or 3 kilometers, I think, from the sea there. They don't really know who used them. They think that possibly fishermen walked them before they went out to sea as a way of centering fishing prospects. So I began to think about making a labyrinth, which I did in this courtyard. So I implanted or placed black stones, which I gathered down by the sea and brought up to the farm within the pre-existing courtyard structure. At the end of the month, invited all these different communities and people I had met. So I had a group of students from the local art college who worked with me. A friend of a friend lived 2 towns away, it turned out. Met, you know, the local postman, the librarian, the historian, and invited folks to come, as well as those who were artists and who were interested in this center called Brunakra, which is in a tiny hamlet, Gislav, in the southern part of Sweden. So we walked the periphery of the farm and then entered the courtyard and entered the labyrinth and walked the full labyrinth. And then we spent time trading stories about being lost. They were really quite extraordinary. Getting lost is kind of a pretty universal experience, be it actually lost, you know, losing your path, or metaphorically, spiritually, psychologically, the various ways in which we can conceive ourselves of being lost.
And you've just invited us to do something similar. We're at the Maid of Walking event in La Romeo, and you've created a labyrinth in a bit of parkland just by laying down stones. Mm-hmm. And you described that as a unicursal.
Yes.
Would you like to explain the differences between different labyrinths and maybe what's a labyrinth and what's a maze?
Yeah, correct. Well, a maze is constructed so that you get lost, actually. And so there's often choices you make, and some of those choices may lead you to a dead end or a way of passage that doesn't put you back. It doesn't let you exit the maze. A labyrinth, on the other hand, it's more of a thinking tool. There is a way to enter and a way to exit. Sometimes you arrive at the center and then you go back out the way you came in, but oftentimes it is a spiralic path that enters an interior space and then continues and exits. So unicursal meaning one path. So you actually don't have a lot of choices to make, and what that allows you to do, and usually you're looking at your feet at the path, is to sort of go on an interior passage, perhaps, thinking, walking, looking at your feet, looking at the path. But I really like the association of the labyrinth with Ariadne and Ariadne's thread. I've become increasingly interested in these methods of wayfinding. And, you know, in contemporary urban design, wayfinding is usually signage, you know, maps that show you where you are, etc. But there are many other ways in which we might understand wayfinding, be they a compass or a string, a path of crumbs, a Polynesian stick map, which really maps currents in the ocean. So there are many ways human beings have sought to construct maps.
Okay, so coming back to the sort of labyrinth, I mean, part of the thing for me, I mean, I have walked a labyrinth and I interviewed someone called Daniela Wilson who used labyrinths. The point about the labyrinth, for what she said, was that people had a certainty about the way they were going, and it was going to be their guide, so they could actually not worry about getting lost. And yet here you're proposing a question to people before they enter the labyrinth, where you ask them to, you explain it rather than me explaining it, and why you choose to ask them to do that.
Yeah. At the beginning of the walk, I ask people to think of a time or multiple times and then sort of to seek out the moment that has the greatest resonance or the greatest impact on their psyche or their memory, times when they were lost. To think deeply about that, to go into that place of anxiety or awareness or mystery or fear, all these different ways in which you respond to being lost. And then I think the labyrinth becomes a kind of thinking tool. And maybe it is because you know there is one direction in and out, because you know there's an end in sight. As you spiral, I think I was, you know, thinking that it's much like putting a blindfold on and being spun in place and then sent off. Well, you kind of lose your sense of direction anyway. But what happens, I think, and what can happen when you're lost is a greater heightened sense of awareness. You start listening to the sounds around you, be it through fear, hearing someone's footsteps in a desolate street, or hearing the sound of a bird in the forest, or hearing a distant shot in the forest of someone hunting. So there's a heightened awareness and a heightened alertness in your senses that you seek to be able to find your way. And maybe what the labyrinth allows for is you to relax into that space of mystery or that space of wondering how I'm going to get out, but also know that there is an end that you can trust so that you can sort of settle into that space of awareness. I think oftentimes when we're lost, we just panic and then we make bad decisions or we kind of lose the potential for that moment to be a heightened space of awareness. I also think, you know, in returning to your question about temporary communities, when these walks are done in groups, that space of slowing down and kind of finding your story that you might want to share with the group, it gives you time to kind of think through your memory and experience. And then when we come together, there's been time. You know, a lot of people won't speak right off the cuff, but if they've had time to develop a little bit of thinking around their story.
Storytelling is really in the zeitgeist. And I mean, you're cutting-edge stuff here. One of those things one could argue is that once one is in the labyrinth and the way is defined, you can then submit yourself to becoming in the flow or becoming into being or whatever. Those kinds of arguments, repetitive, circular or spiraling walking would allow you to get into a process of deeper thought. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's gold dust. People have paid a fortune to get people into modes of clearer thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And storytelling certainly is something we need more of. I think it's a way for us to tell our own stories and, in a sense, to make sure our voices are participants in our histories as opposed to being written from some external authorial voice, you know, that isn't including all of us. So I think that notion of storytelling as a kind of personal voice within history is really important. What I aim for actually is kind of to allow space for multiple voices to enter and not to make it feel like a, I'm not a professional orator, I'm not a professional storyteller, I'm really an amateur, and to invite the amateurs to participate, really to invite participants to share from the mundane to the more profound moments they've experienced. And I think through that kind of potential of a kind of temporary community is formed, and there's an intimacy that develops in that space.
Well, certainly, because what I found doing it, I hadn't done it with a group of other people, so
right.
Not only was I obviously following someone and being followed,
mm-hmm.
but once we, when some people had reached the center and I was getting nearer and nearer the center myself, the people were coming back in the opposite direction beside me, and sort of, it was sort of like they were the meat in the sandwich. And there was kind of stuff like that going on, and I was thinking, I almost don't want this to finish.
Yeah.
It'd be really nice to keep this going for a lot longer.
Yeah.
Do you think there's an optimum duration that people should try this that then allows them to get to a point of clearer thinking?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think there is something about a bar for entry, which if the project is 3 hours long, I think people are, I'm busy, I can't do that. I think if you have an hour and you're coming for an hour, hour and a half, I think more people will participate, which I think is a positive outcome. I think you could structure it longer as well and invite who comes. I'm not sure if there's an optimal way, but I do think when you go, for example, moving away from the labyrinth and walking, when you go on a long journey, when you hike a pilgrimage for many, many days or months, you develop a kind of communitas from that wandering together and walking together. And there is something about an extended time that deepens those relationships, even though they're still temporary. I mean, I met people on the Camino myself, who I don't really keep in touch with, but those were incredibly valuable relationships that I learned from in the moment. And so I think what's amazing about duration is that intimacy can occur quite quickly. So the storytelling, for example, that happened this morning took us about an hour to walk to the site, walk the labyrinth, and then exchange stories about being lost and finding our way. And really within a short period of time, we've all become quite close. And that always strikes me as quite extraordinary. Barriers can come down that we might normally have in terms of engaging with other people. They can come down quite quickly.
As I was jokingly saying to you, you can buy these labyrinths printed on a mat and roll them out.
Right. I'm interested in this way in which the community is mobile, right? And the community can travel together, walking together. I mean, I'm very interested in these stories of the troubadour, the hablador, the traveling storyteller in Iceland is called the sagamadur. There are all these different histories of people who move and tell stories, but I do think they are always materially cited, which is to say site-specific also. And I think that the site is important. So for me,
rolling out a mat isn't quite.
Yeah, exactly. It's not quite enough for me. Like I'm interested in the fact that I take the stones from this location and they bear this extra level of material meaning that may not be didactically presented, but that it exists in connection with that site. I feel that connection with the locale, the ground that you're walking on, is very important.
It sounds as though what you're suggesting, which would have some real positive value, is if there were ambassadors carrying stories to different localities and different communities or developing communities in those localities who could then exchange stories and take them to another place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have I got that right?
Well, I think that there is this real importance to this kind of work that is actually mobile. You know, I think it's like a pollinating bee. It stops and spends time in a place and moves on and pollinates somewhere else. And I think historically the role of those mobile storytellers is a person who takes stories from one place and carries them to the next. And they're in a sense like a news conduit, creating webs of connection. And if we recognize the failures of our internet webs of connection, which I think we do as sort of pretty holistically as a culture now. We understand that there's limits to that social engagement that we find online. That this kind of social interaction that happens temporarily in small communities in these sites actually creates a web of connection that's quite important and unique and historically significant, actually. And I think that we have to maintain those methods of storytelling.
Yeah. In the last couple of years, you've actually invited artists, walking artists, performers and other people to come to a kind of... It was a colloquium or a symposium,
right,
or festival. Describe the event.
It's hard to come to a term for it, actually. I called it Platform Projects Walks. I invited 14 different artists to come, and then a lot of local artists, some who don't normally make walks, some who do, created in total 8 walks. There were a number of artist lectures. We watched a couple films. We had 5 different reading dialogues where readings were offered if you were interested, and we met in local cafes and discussed them. We had a night of video shorts. It was a way for me to expand that idea of bringing people together. It was a 2-week project. Every day we had 1 or 2 or 3 events. It was a great way to bring the community together. So I'm hoping to do more of them. It's maybe an every other year thing. This year I'm teaching a walking art history class as well at the college, but I'm hoping to offer a community class that's similar, that brings, again, people together for walks and readings and discussions. And there was a pedagogical aspect to it, but also anyone could come in at any time to Platform Projects Walks and participate on any level. So a lecture is very easy. You walk in, you walk out. A walk maybe is more time. A reading is even more commitment. And so there were different levels in which people would engage, and that was really fun and exciting. It was a great group that came together. I think we had 275, 300 people over the course of a couple of weeks that came through, which was good. Yeah, it was a fun project.
Would you like to suggest a couple of walks to the listeners?
Sure. Well, if you come to Portland, Maine, we have a relatively small peninsula, and you can actually walk in a circle around the peninsula. On one side of the peninsula is a cove, and there's a circle walk around that. And they're kind of maybe in the same way as a labyrinth. You know that you will come back around to where you started. Perhaps, like T.S. Eliot says, you come back and you see it again from a new perspective. I think if you have the privilege to make the space in your life to walk the pilgrimage route, like the Camino de Santiago, even a small portion of it, it's incredibly revealing. And I'm grateful I've had the chance to do that. I walked a portion of it in Spain some years back, and I recommend that for sure.
And any particular section that you walked?
Galicia was quite amazing. And I will say it's amazing also because I'd already walked 3 weeks prior, and so my legs were ready for it. So if you're walking 30 kilometers a day, it does take some preparation, but it's some extraordinary mountains to walk through there. I always seek out mountainous areas. Hiked in the Himalayas and in the Atlas in Morocco, and those spaces where you ascend and are able to gain a different perspective in the landscape around you, I find very compelling. And so that area of Galicia, you can climb some of the larger hills, and some of them are less, not quite mountains, but you get an incredible vista before you where you can really capture an extraordinary sense of the landscape from a distance.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Julie Poitras-Santos. If you've any views on this interview or on any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.